Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Turkey and Syria exchanging cross-border mortar shelling for a fifth day, with the Turkish Prime Minister saying the two countries are not far from war. Asli Bali, a professor in the UCLA School of Law who is on the Advisory Council of the Middle East Division of Human Rights Watch, joins us to discuss the escalation of war in the region. Then we'll get an assessment of the role of journalism in the presidential debates following the first exchange between Romney and Obama, where the big questions hovering over the campaign about Mitt Romney's taxes and his attitude towards the 47% were not discussed. The founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, Tom Rosensteel, joins us to discuss how the American people and our democracy are not being served by these staged and circumscribed events. Then finally, we will speak with Lynn Povich about how she and a group of the good girls at Newsweek, during the era of madmen and male chauvinism, revolted against being secretaries and researchers and sued their bosses and changed journalism. Lynn Povich is the author of the new book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. And joining us now is Asli Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She is on the Advisory Council of the Middle East Division of Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asli Bali.
Thank you for having me.
And Turkish artillery have returned fire into Syria for a fifth day now, and where mortars from Syria landed on a border village, which was fortunately vacated. But last week in the town of Akakali, I guess it's pronounced, there was the death of five civilians, which included two women and three children. That really upset the Turkish Prime Minister and, I guess, by extension, the Turkish people.
That's right. There's been tremendous public consternation about what's happening at the Turkish border at this point. As you mentioned, the border town of Akçakale has unfortunately faced a tremendous amount of pressure as Tel Abyad on the Syrian side of the border, so the town on the Syrian side of the border that is currently the site of hot conflict between the rebel groups, various rebel groups which hold that town, and the Syrian government forces. As that fighting goes on, what appear to be errant mortars are crossing into Akçakale, and it's creating a situation, as you mentioned, five consecutive days now of Turkish reprisal action into Syria is the most, sort of instability and cross-border violence that we've seen since the beginning of events in Syria some 20 months ago.
So what is happening then? The New York Times on Sunday is carrying a front page story suggesting that the Saudis and the Qataris have wanted to arm the Syrian rebels with shoulder-fired missiles and more than just the AK-47 assault rifles, which just seem to be pretty much all they have. And these efforts have been vetoed by the United States. Apparently, the U.S. doesn't want the rebels armed more than they are. And then on September the 5th, the Prime Minister Erdogan of Turkey scolded Obama for his lack of policy and initiatives on Syria during an interview with CNN. So what is the attitude in Turkey about what the U.S. is doing? So if the U.S. is the one that's basically in charge here, given that they've basically been restraining Qatar and Saudi Arabia?
So first I would just say that I think there's lots of evidence that much heavier weapons have entered into Syria, including the fact that Syrian rebels have successfully fired on Syrian regime air forces and air power, and that there's every reason to think that there are, in fact, shoulder-fired missiles and so forth at the act. That the Syrian rebels have had access to and have exhibited a capacity to deploy in the last couple of months. I also think that it's overstated to claim that the Saudis and Qataris are somehow being radically held back. I think there are a number of things that are going on at the international level. From the perspective of the Syrian rebels, of course, they're very frustrated. They want much stronger support, including much more sophisticated weapons, but also a no-fly zone, and they also want a border region to be created that's a kind of buffer zone. I think what's happening right now at the border is potentially the nascent form of that border zone. I mean, Syrian rebels have basically engaged government forces in such a way that errant mortar, and basically to date, there hasn't been any clear definitive determination that that shelling or the mortar fire that's come in has in fact not been from the rebels themselves. I mean, the mortar fire that's falling into Turkey is coming from this border town, and it's impossible to know whether or not it's government forces or rebel forces that are responsible.
So what exactly did the Turkish Prime Minister say then on CNN, where he was complaining about the lack of policy and initiatives on the part of the United States vis-a-vis Syria?
So there has been a general idea that the United States is somehow, and this is something that's really held by the rebels on the ground as well, that the U.S. government is using the pretext, quote-unquote, of the Security Council's inaction to basically fail to engage more seriously in Syria. So the claim is that it's convenient that the Russians and the Chinese are opposed to more substantial engagement in Syria because that offers cover at a time that there's a U.S. presidential election underway to avoid making substantial decisions or commitments in Syria on the part of the United States. I think that that is a misreading in some ways and correct in other ways. It's correct in the following way. There's no clear course at the moment through which an intervention in Syria, whether it took the form of much heavier weaponry for the rebels or a no-fly zone or a buffer zone or various of the ideas that the Turkish Prime Minister and others have floated, would actually do more good than harm from the perspective of either A, bringing an end to the conflict, or B, alleviating the humanitarian suffering of the population on the ground. I think all of those courses of action are extremely dangerous for a variety of reasons that, you know, many have already detailed, including the location of Syria, the other countries in the region that may very well get drawn into a conflagration there, the potential to further escalate the actual violence, that you might end up in a place where you have a circumstance where both parties escalate the violence dramatically, but neither is able to establish a substantial enough gain on the other to actually prevail. And so you just have a much, much more violent civil conflict underway, that you have outside forces infiltrating that no party is really able to control, including potentially terrorist groups that are attracted to Syria from other parts of the world, and so forth. So there are all kinds of risks. And so I do think it's the case, I do think it's true, that there's no appetite for intervening in Syria on the part of the United States or other Western powers, even France, which has taken a more aggressive posture, independent of whether or not Russia and China exercise a veto on the Security Council. There is a desire to be much more, to censure Syria, to place much more pressure on Iran with respect to its relationship to Syria. But in terms of direct willingness to commit either materiel or forces on the ground, I think that there is real reluctance to do that for fear of getting drawn into another conflict in the Middle East that has a very uncertain trajectory at this point, even with intervention from outside. So I think what the Turkish Prime Minister is reacting to or expressing frustration about is that fact, that notwithstanding the Russian and Chinese positions, actually there is no clear direction that the United States or others is willing at this point to endorse. And Turkey would like to see a dramatically stepped up commitment on the part of its NATO allies to engage in much more forceful intervention. I think that that's a very sort of blinkered view that the Turkish Prime Minister has adopted, which has much more to do with goals that Turkey has in the region and in Syria than it has to do with the benefits that might flow from that posture to Syrian civilians or just to the capacity to terminate the Syrian conflict. And as a result, and I should say, by the way, that opposition within Turkey to the Prime Minister's position is also consolidating. I mean, there is a tremendous distress in Turkey amongst the Turkish public about what is perceived as the bellicosity of the prime minister. And it's becoming a source of increasing division and friction within Turkey. This is one place where he has taken a very clear position, at least domestically in the political spectrum, and has actually lost support even from among his own supporters, in part because people fear getting pulled into a war with Syria, in part also because people fear what the implications of this bellicose posture are for domestic Turkish considerations, including the relationship with the Kurdish community in the southeast, including the relationship with the IDV community within Turkey. So people are quite uncomfortable, and there have been notable pro-peace, anti-intervention protests and demonstrations in Turkey over the course of the last 5 days.
Again, I'm speaking with Asli Bal, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She's on the Advisory Council of the Middle East Division of Human Rights Watch. Now, my understanding is that Turkey believes that Syria's Kurds, you mentioned the Kurds, Turkey believes that Syria's Kurds are assisting the PKK, that's the Kurdistan Workers' Party, who have been intensifying their campaign against the Turkish military since the Syrian crisis began. They also believe that the Assad regime is assisting the Syrian Kurds in assisting the PKK. So what is going on there? Is Assad stirring the pot there?
Yes. So Assad has indicated that if Turkey carries on, and again, one has to step back and remember that Turkey has for the last, you know, over 18 months now, allowed the Free Syrian Army and the Syrian National Council and other opposition groups to operate from within Turkey, establish headquarters in Turkey, establish media bureaus in Turkey, you know, run their PR campaign out of Turkey and so forth. So Turkey has taken a very clear position in support of the opposition forces and has called for Bashar al-Assad to step down and so forth. So the posture between the two countries has been one in which Turkey is offering support to rebel groups that are engaged in direct hostilities of the Syrian government. The Syrian government's response has been to say, we have no reason to restrain Kurdish groups, either A, from taking shelter in our territory after engaging in attacks against Turkish forces within Turkey, or B, organizing in whatever way they would like, across between the Turkish Kurdish community and the Syrian Kurdish community, if they wish to coordinate, if they wish to engage in joint action and so forth. We no longer have any reason as a regime to interfere with their activities, and so we will give them free rein. And this is basically our response to you, Turkey, or you, Prime Minister Erdogan, your willingness to house forces that have taken up arms against our regime. We no longer see any reason why we should prevent forces that have taken up arms against your regime from operating in our territory. So it's really a tit-for-tat position. And, of course, it has had a very significant impact in Turkey. Now, having said that, it would be a mistake, I think, to frame this as the Kurdish rebel groups in Turkey have stepped up their violence since the hostilities began in Syria. I think actually the more appropriate thing to say is that the Turkish government returned basically in 2010 to direct repression of the Kurdish community and punitive measures against elected civilian leaders in the Turkish Kurdish community. And as a result, we have seen an increase in sort of support for rebel factions and a kind of sense of futility among Kurdish communities of the sort of investment in peaceful civilian politics because of the incredible repression that they've faced from the Turkish government, which is completely independent of and predates events in Syria.
Well, just in closing, Asli Bali, this situation, I think, is destined to get worse, is it not, given that we've been discussing the lack of policy or the extent to which the election considerations here in the United States perhaps restraining the president from any real action, and any real action itself is fraught with problems. So I get the impression that nobody quite knows how to get out of this situation. Is that right?
Well, so again, I should say that it's the Turkish prime minister and others that are claiming that it's the U.S. presidential election that is leading to no real action. My own position is that it's the absence of a clear course to take. The only course, a clear course involving greater intervention in the conflict that would somehow yield any benefit. I think that there's almost no case to be made that you can engage short of a full air campaign and then ground invasion of Syria, which would then, of course, alter dramatically the calculation that's on the table right now, not necessarily for the better, but it would be very difficult to calculate at this moment what the consequences of some incredible commitment of force a la Iraq would look like in Syria. I think that would be a disastrous error. But short of that kind of a commitment, I don't think that one can establish at all that there's a way militarily to end this conflict. I think that means there is a course, and I think it's a course that hasn't been invested in adequately at all by the United States or, for that matter, by the Turkish government or others. And that course is, if you can't end this conflict militarily, if there's no clear way, in the short term at least, to bring to an end the fighting that has endangered the civilian population militarily, then the way to go is to try to structure a negotiated outcome in Syria. And here you had the Egyptian Prime Minister Morsi step forward and engage in, the Egyptian President Morsi step forward and engage in an initiative that I thought was extremely promising, in which, crucially, he brought the Egyptians, the Turks, the Saudis, and the Iranians within a single mediating framework in order to, and of course, all of the Syrian factions. The idea was to have a negotiation in which you had the supporters of both sides also at the table. Now, Saudi Arabia balked at this. It's not at all clear if it's sustainable, but that would be a much more productive direction, in my view, for the U.S. or others to invest, which is to say, and that the principles within the country, but more importantly, their external supporters, come to a negotiation together so that it actually involves a compromise involving all of the parties that at this point are stakeholders in this conflict. And unfortunately, because there is such a strong regional presence of stakeholders, including the ones you've named, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, as supporters of the opposition, who continually basically send the message to opposition forces on the ground that they should not and need not compromise with the regime because time is on their side, they will eventually prevail because they have tremendous outside support and the Syrian regime has few friends. But they have friends. The Syrian regime on its side has Iran regionally and Russia internationally supporting it. And if you can't bring the Russians and the Iranians to a table around a negotiation, then the reality is you're not engaging in meaningful negotiation. You're simply speaking to your own counterparts among your allies or those who have taken a similar position on Syria, and that is not a productive way to negotiate and enter the conflict. If, by contrast, you were to engage, and engaging means not only bringing to the table, but actually being prepared to make concessions, including regional concessions. For example, obviously, Iran's currency has now lost 40% of its value almost overnight. It's under tremendous economic strain and so forth. The parties that have imposed sanctions on Iran are the same parties that support the Syrian rebels. And there's plenty of room for a coordinated negotiation where all parties could get something that they're seeking regionally in exchange for bringing real pressure to bear, both on the Syrian regime and on armed rebel groups, to desist from the fighting. And I think that's the only course available at this point that even has a hope of securing an end to the hostilities that we're seeing. And again, what we haven't discussed, but what is crucial, is to bear in mind that 20,000 to 30,000 Syrian civilians have been killed, and some 250,000 to 400,000 have left the country, with tens of thousands more internally displaced at this point. I mean, the price is being paid for this conflict is being paid in the blood of Syrian civilians. And unfortunately, all of this kind of regional posturing around the situation in Syria does not any of it correspond to individual actors, whether it's Turkey or the United States or Saudi Arabia or Iran, that have the welfare of Syrian civilians first and foremost in their policy priorities.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Asli Bali.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Asli Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She is on the Advisory Council of the Middle East Division of Human Rights Watch. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the founder and director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism about the role of journalism in the presidential debates.